There's a growing gap in education in the United States, and this time, boys are the ones being left behind. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today and tomorrow, we're going to explore gender differences in our children and the challenges they create. Today, we start with boys, tomorrow, girls. This hour, we'll get insight into how boys develop, how they're influenced by video games and media, the challenges and dangers they face as they grow, and we'll talk about why our education system doesn't seem to be working as well for boys as it used to. We also want to hear your questions and concerns. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today and tomorrow, we're going to explore gender differences in our children and some of the challenges they create. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about girls. Today, we're starting with the boys. We'll start off with child development and talk about some of the changes boys go through as they grow. Later in the hour, we'll talk about how boys are influenced by video games and media, the challenges and dangers they face as they grow, and we'll talk about why our education system doesn't seem to be working as well for boys as it used to. You can also join our conversation with your questions and concerns. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can post on our Facebook page or call 866-780-9100. My first guest today is Gwen Dayton, early childhood specialist who works in the toddler classroom at the University of Northern Iowa Child Development Center. Hello, Gwen.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I understand that gender differences is not your area of expertise, but you do work with a lot of small children. And of course, all toddlers have a lot of things in common, but there are some differences that emerge between boys and girls in those early years. What are some of the differences that you start to see?
Well, I think that much of what happens in our classrooms is an extension of what happens in society. So some of my coworkers will say that with the older preschoolers, starting maybe at about age three, they start to notice that the activity level of boys is sometimes a little bit higher if they have a predominantly male classroom. They will sometimes have a volume increase, they've noticed. But really, as toddlers, we come at programming as individuals. And so other than doing some of the things that our National Association for the Education of Young Children, NAACI, suggests and advocates for, and our state program, the Iowa Early Learning Standards, set forth guidelines to help us make sure that our classrooms are providing environments that stimulate both boys and girls.
Now, you mentioned the societal expectations, and of course, when we do go to the store, often we'll see the pink aisle in the toy store and the blue aisle in the toy store, and we know that, of course, children have differences, but there are these stereotypes that do seem to be borne out in what boys seem to be drawn to more and girls seem to be drawn to more. We do see more boys interested in cars, for example, and more girls interested in dolls. Do you see that in your classroom?
Sometimes I do. I have to wonder sometimes if that's what they're most familiar with, because that's maybe what they've gotten at home, because their parents do shop in those certain aisles. We try and counter that in the classroom by allowing each of the center's toys to go into the other. So if we have the trucks and blocks in one area, we try and juxtapose that against the housekeeping area and then let the blocks come into the housekeeping area so that, and vice versa, the housekeeping things go into the blocks so that we can start to incorporate them and broaden their interests into other play scenarios that they may not have gravitated towards originally.
Another area where research shows us that there tends to be difference is in language acquisition. What do you see in children of that age?
Sometimes we expect girls would score higher on language assessments but typically I really don't see that. We do several different assessments throughout the year, three specifically, and all of those have a component for language. And our boys tend to score just as well as the boys. Of course, it's something that toddlers developmentally are really exciting, and it's a dynamic part of their development. Once that language starts to happen, it's exciting for families and empowering for the children as they acquire the language that they need in order to get their needs met and express themselves.
Do you see differences in social behavior?
I see differences in children's social behavior.
So,
but
Gwen,
really
I'm hearing you say that you don't see gender differences in the children that you work with, is what I'm hearing from you.
I really don't so much at the toddler level. And if I do, it's quite possibly because that's the way that our society has kind of structured it. Sometimes girls' gross motor development is a little bit delayed, and I look at them wearing the beautiful little dresses and shiny patent shoes that are slippery, and so, or the sandals that have open toes, and it makes it very difficult for them to walk and move. In a dress, of course, they can't crawl, and knees get scraped up, and so I would see factors that would influence their gross motor development dependent on what they wear to school.
Although, of course, parents aren't making all of those decisions either.
They are not. They are not. They and parents are influenced, and oftentimes parents, you know, will dress their daughters in the tennis shoes and the jeans or the long pants that need to be facilitating their daughter's movement just as much as the girls. So I guess that if I do see differences in the development between boys and girls, it would be, once again, and maybe we'll talk more about that later when we get to society's impact.
Well, Gwen, thank you so much for talking with me. I want to bring Suzanne Friedman into the conversation. She's a professor of human development, also at the University of Northern Iowa, and her focus is on adolescence. And Suzanne, one of the things that is important for us to understand is that the brains of children are different from the brains of adults. And I think as parents and teachers, we often try to understand kids by thinking about how we react to situations. But what do we need to know about the adolescent brain?
Good question, Charity. One of the things we need to know about the adolescent brain is that the frontal lobe is not completely developed until about age 25. So when we think about teenagers, we need to remember that the part of the brain that controls decision-making, impulsiveness, rational thought is still a work in progress. And we tend to forget that as parents and teachers. Why can our children be so organized in one area and very forgetful in another area? Why do they make decisions without thinking about the consequences? Why do they do things with their peers that they might not do by themselves? Is all influenced by the fact that the frontal lobe is not completely developed.
As young people grow, of course, they go through puberty. A lot of things are going on in the body. How do all those hormones affect the brain?
Well, that's a good question. So we often think that when we think of our early adolescents and the fact that they're going through puberty, that it's all about hormones, that their behavior is solely attributed to the increase in hormones. And that is definitely part of it. But when you think about early adolescents, there's a lot of things going on. They're having school transitions often to junior high, middle school. Their roles are expanding in terms of what they're responsible for. They may be starting to get little jobs. Babysitting, paper route. My daughter started walking a dog for a neighbor. And they also have different teachers. So before they had one teacher, now they have a lot of different teachers that they have to, you know, keep track of with different classes. And there's more homework. So definitely part of it is hormones, but their life is changing too. And social transitions, a lot of changes with friendships. So there's a lot going on. You know, equal to the amount of development that occurs prenatally and during infancy.
Common wisdom tells us that girls mature faster than boys. Is that something that seems to be borne out in the adolescent years?
Girls do go through puberty on average earlier than boys, and boys start a little bit later and take longer to go through the process. And as parents and teachers, we need to remember that although girls and boys may look physically mature because their body has changed, emotionally and cognitively, they are not. And that's hard when you're looking at a child and they look very physically developed. But in terms of, you know, the way they're feeling and thinking, they're still 12 or 13, even though they might look like they're 17.
And let's talk about how boys start to define themselves as they grow. Where do some of their identity ideas come from?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there's been a lot of work on identity development and differences between males and females. And boys tend, if you ask them, you know, in adolescence, they would define themselves about their interests, what they like to do, what they're good at, maybe a possible future career. And girls may say some of that stuff, but they also define themselves a lot by their relationships, their different roles in their life, whether they're a daughter, a friend, a girlfriend, a granddaughter. So they base their identity more on the relationships they have. And that's changing a lot, but an identity is something that develops. Eric Erickson talked about the adolescent years as being, you know, a crisis in identity. And now we know that, you know, most adolescents don't experience a crisis in their identity development. And it, identity keeps on developing past age 18. A male could be solidified in one aspect of their identity, but questioning other aspects.
Right. Well, and of course, as kids grow, the society influences also grow. Mm-hmm. Sports tend to play an even larger role in the lives of most boys than they do in the lives of girls. What kind of expectations does that put on boys, and how do you think that influences their identity?
Well, I think there is a lot of pressure. There's more pressure for boys to be involved in sports than there is for girls, although I do think a lot of girls are involved in sports, but I don't think the pressure is the same. So if you're a boy who isn't involved in sports, depending on the community you live in, I think it's true in smaller communities that it's like, wow, you don't play sports. I think it's harder for to be a boy when there's so much focus and involvement, not just by the boys themselves, but the whole community, the school. There's a lot of praise and attention given to boys who play sports. And I think it's harder for boys who don't to find their niche and to feel good about who they are. Not that it's impossible, but there is a lot of pressure.
Right. Well, Suzanne, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Suzanne Friedman is a professor of human development at the University of Northern Iowa. Gwen Dayton, also early childhood specialist who works in the toddler classroom at the University of Northern Iowa Child Development Center. Thank you, Gwen.
You're welcome.
And in a moment, we're going to talk more about the risks that boys face as they grow. We're going to talk about media influences, including video games, in just a moment as well. And later in the hour, we're going to focus on our education system and a growing gap in education between girls and boys. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about boys. Today and tomorrow, we're exploring gender differences in our children and some of the challenges they may create. Tomorrow, we will be talking about girls. But like I said, today is the day for the boys. And joining me now is Denise Denton. She is a prevention specialist at Youth and Shelter Services in Ames. She's been doing this for 38 years. Hello, Denise.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
And, you know, we talk a lot about risks that teenagers face. And as kids grow, of course, there are lots of dangers that they encounter. What are some of the risks that you see the boys that you work with really encountering?
You know, before I was here, I was at Ames High meeting with a group that I meet with regularly there. It's a leadership group. And so I said, you know, after I leave here, I'm going over to the radio station to be on the radio talking about what makes it risky to be a boy today. And the common consensus was teenage girls. That was their response. Both boys and girls said, what makes it risky to be boys is teenage girls. I'm not sure that's what we're looking for on this program. But there are a lot of things that make it risky to be boys, certainly. And I would underscore some of the things that Suzanne said, which is it's their very brain. And there's good reason for that. The brain does develop at, you know, different skill sets, as it were, at different times. And the brain really goes through about three different growth spurts, significant growth spurts, one of which is before we even, you know, have a first birthday, when at about 6, 7, 8 months gestation, there's a huge pruning that goes on where we sort of lose half of our brain matter. And by the time we do have our first day at school, when we're born, we have virtually nothing, which is why I think mostly we just drool the first few days. But then we start all over again, and we have this huge neural proliferation where we're learning all kinds of things, walking and talking. And then at age sort of two-ish three, it goes through with scissors and clips you back again. It's when you get to be about 11 and a half for girls and 12 for boys that you start on that sort of final frontier. And the brain is so plastic, plasticity meaning that there's just such opportunity for them to learn. But during that same time, when those frontal lobes that Suzanne talked about start to come more online and they're being able to reason more, they're still very vulnerable, because the part of the brain that speaks to them about risk is really what is driving the bus at that point. I mean, different parts of the brain do different things, and those frontal lobes that don't really come online till we're about 25 are the things that really talk to us about consequences. But until we get to that point, we're really driven by that center part of the brain that has to do with survival. And I was telling the kids this morning that we're really only as smart as sort of our last 50,000-year-old ancestor, because the brain really didn't finish growing or finish developing till about then. And we really haven't progressed much beyond 50,000 years ago. So what did you need to do about 50,000 years ago? You needed to get out of the cave or you'd starve to death. So risk really had a very significant purpose. You needed to go out there and think that you could outrun the raptor, or you'd not come home with lunch. Well, 50,000 years ago, you could probably outrun the raptor. We have inherited that brain that says that risk is essential for our survival, but now it's a little tougher to outrun bullets and fast cars and drugs. So while we have the same kind of brain that talks about risk, we have different sorts of things that we're trying to get ahead of. And of course, when you have a brain that is always looking for risk, you have a brain that always is putting you at risk. So you're in sort of a push-me-pull-me sort of situation. You just can't win.
And
it's
male,
catch-22.
Male brains tend to be more engaged in this risk assessment?
Well, the different structures in the limbic system, which is really about survival, do seem to take on different significance at different parts of our development. And part of the limbic system that is particularly emotional is called the amygdala. It's sort of the crossing guard for emotions in the brain. It's sort of when you're happy, it adds the giggles, and when you're sad, it adds the tears, and when you're scared, it adds the goosebumps. And that is actually a little bit enlarged when you are a teenage boy and you add hormones to that. You know, Suzanne referred to that, the hormones and the brain development together. The hormones don't totally drive the conversation, but they certainly set the tone. And you put the hormones together with the brain development and the peer pressure, their environment, and you have a perfect storm for things going either very right or very wrong, given a situation. And here's a good example of that. There was some research that was done where they put newly minted drivers and old people like me into car simulators, and they had them, you know, do a variety of, ooh, what would you do now? Here's a yellow light. Do you run it? Do you keep going with a red light? Do you stop? It's a good idea if you do. And everyone performed beautifully until they put another teenager in the simulator with the teenage driver, and then they ran the yellow or red light almost every time. The very fact that you have another set of that kind of brain and those hormones in the car with you, the need to impress, the need to be distracted, all of those things, makes it more dangerous. There's such a thing as personal fable in a teenage brain, where you believe that your life is as it should be, or you believe your life will be as it should be. So it's okay for other people to run the red light. Bad things might happen to them, but it probably won't happen to me. And probably a good example of that is I found myself in a room full of young people after a suicide. And these were all friends of the young person who was deceased. And this young man who had died had a long history of suicide attempts. This was no secret. And he finally, in fact, got it done, sadly. But his friends were stunned. They could not believe that this had happened. And knowing their long history with him, I was surprised that they were surprised. So I said, I don't understand why you are so shocked. And the one young man said, well, you know, it's interesting because just the other day he and I were talking about this. And I said, well, tell me more about that. And he said, yeah, we were out on a country road. It was about 2 a.m. We're driving on gravel, 90 miles an hour with the lights off and having this conversation. I said, oh, my word, that is suicidal behavior. He said, no, no, it's not, because I do that all the time and I don't want to die. That kind of thinking puts young people at risk.
We also see boys involved at a much higher rate in violent incidents, violent crime, or even just fighting.
Yes.
Is there something about the male brain that leads to that kind of behavior, or is this a societal expectation? Or both?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
You know, that's sort of that amygdala at work with a little extra testosterone thrown on top. But there also is research that speaks to the fact that young men in particular have a tougher time distinguishing tonal sorts of cues. And so you can raise your voice or not raise your voice. They still think you're in a fight mode. They don't recognize the kinds of intonations that you and I might use as cues as to whether somebody is being threatening or not. But the other thing that happens with teenage brains at about age 12 is, this sounds strange, but they lose facial recognition. In other words, they're not as good, again, with facial cues. So the research that was done was where they put both adults and teenagers in functional MRIs. And functional MRIs measure, you know, how your brain responds during a given set of opportunities. So what they did was they showed different pictures of facial expressions to the adults and to the young people. And with the adults, they were able to recognize the difference between sad, mad, glad, happy, surprised every time. When they put the teenagers in the functional MRIs, the response they got back was mad, 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 mad. So they were more likely to perceive a negative sort of facial expression rather than being able to distinguish those. And when I read that research right away, I'm thinking, well, no wonder there are so many, you know, back alley fights and schoolyard scuffles. And another example of that is a meeting that I was in where it was a group of students who were not particularly happy about a policy that was being proposed at the university concerning, a lack of alcoholic beverages. So these young people were not of the opinion that the available of alcohol should be reduced. And I was with a number of people who were discussing this with them. And I said nothing during this. My job was really just to nod and to encourage. And so at the end of this conversation, one of the young men turned to one of the other people and said, I don't like what you have to say. And then he turned to me and he said, and I haven't liked the look on your face all night. And I thought, oh, there's a young man who is having a little trouble with facial recognition, because I never frowned. I was being very careful about my expression, just nodding. But he misinterpreted, I think, most of my expression. And so, you know, that sort of thing can lead to more confrontation if you think that the person that you're looking at is being adversarial.
And I want to bring, there's so much more we could talk about, but stay with us. I'm talking with Denise Denton. She's a prevention specialist at Youth and Shelter Services in Ames. I also want to bring Douglas Gentile into this conversation. He is assistant professor of developmental psychology at Iowa State University. He's also done extensive research on video games and how they influence us. And I think, of course, again, we're talking about expectations, but also natural inclinations. And a lot more boys are playing video games than girls, although there are plenty of girl gamers out there as well. Doug, what do we see about boys that seems to attract them to this technology?
Well, I think that boys certainly do seem to be more attracted to video games, but that's really been changing in the past 10 years, partly as the game industry has started to make games that appeal more to some of the themes girls are interested in, but also as they've become more mainstream, certainly it's about 90% of girls are playing games now too. So I think part of the issue is, what are those themes that are being played, and what are the effects? And one of the interesting things listening to Denise here is, you know, there are some studies that also show that playing a violent video game, for example, reduces kids' ability to detect facial emotions. so that they stop being as good at discriminating, you know, fine differences between them. And so if there is already this natural inclination in that direction, and then they are playing games where the theme is people are going to be aggressive, well, you train that in even deeper, that you expect everyone around you is behaving for some aggressive or hostile motive. And one of the funny things about this is these, you know, as parents, we do notice differences between, you know, boys and girls. But we may not recognize how early that begins, how early they start picking up these cultural norms. So when my older daughter was three, she got sick on a weekend, which, of course, is when kids seem to get sick.
Always, yes.
Yeah. And so our doctor's office was closed, so I had to take her to an urgent care clinic across town. We'd never been here before. And as we're getting out of the car in the parking lot, she says to me, "I think it's going to be a boy." I say, "What?" She says, "I think it'll be a boy." "What's going to be a boy?" "The doctor." "Okay, might be. Why do you think that?" And she said, "Because only boys are doctors." And my jaw just dropped, because I only go to female doctors. Her mother only goes to female doctors. We've only taken her to female doctors. I only go to female dentists. I work in a university where there are a lot of women named Dr. So-and-so. She's never actually experienced a male doctor in her life. Her real world experiences only female doctors, and yet by age three, somehow she's already got this idea that only boys can be doctors. I have no idea where that came from. It's, you know, but in those early preschool years is when they're actually starting to soak up these cultural influences.
We talk a lot about media influence on girls, and we will talk about that tomorrow with a body image and ideas about how you behave in relationships and all kinds of different influences. What kinds of images are boys seeing in media that are influencing how they think they may need to behave?
Sure. Well, one of the interesting things about media is, although we access it thinking that, you know, we're just being entertained, that doesn't mean we aren't learning from it. And one of the things that's made humans the dominant species on the planet is we nurture our young for far longer than pretty much any other species, certainly than any other primate species. For 18 years, we are nurturing them, training them in how, you know, how to be a successful adult. But in the past 50 years, we've really relinquished a lot of that training over to the media. And so the average school-age child now spends 31 hours a week in front of a television, another 10 hours doing non-school-related time on the computer, and another 13 hours in front of video games. That's over 50 hours a week we're allowing the media to nurture our children. That's a full-time job and another 13 hours of overtime. And if someone came up to your door and said, "Hi, I'd like to come in and teach your children values and what it means to be a man," we'd have some questions for them before we let them in. But we're not even questioning, you know, what they get in front of for 50 some hours a week now. And the themes in the media, and this is, you know, true across television and in movies and in video games and in music, for example, are pretty similar, that, you know, they tend to be pretty stereotypical. That's, you know, we can think of cases where that's not true, but those are more the exceptions than the rules. And men are shown as doers. They are shown as people who can, you know, fix things. They are shown as people who are good at sports. They are shown as active. They are shown as strong. And they are not shown as emotionally complex. We're basically allowed one emotion, and that's anger. You know, women, on the other hand, are allowed sadness, but not anger. And so no one's shown as really a full human. We're shown this little slice of one piece of it. And if we look, for example, at content analyses of TV shows or of magazines or things like this, it's, you know, there are these very striking differences. Female characters talk about relationships. They talk about appearance. When other comments are made about female characters, it's often about appearance. When, you know, male characters are talking or talking about other male characters, it tends to be about work or about sports or about, again, doing things. And you know, that's just in the kind of basic roles of how to walk through the world. if we think about then aggressive roles, you know, men are portrayed as, first of all, aggressive and in a physical way, whereas women tend to be portrayed as relationally aggressive, where they say mean things to each other, they spread rumors about each other, they, you know, I'm having a party and you're not invited. The funny thing is, although we think of those as more masculine and feminine forms of aggression, you know, boys use relational aggression pretty much the same amount as girls do. We, again, you know, going back to one of the earlier comments, we don't really see such big differences in the real world, but we continue to be shown these differences through the media, and those become kind of the, you know, the prototype. If I want to be a man, I now have been shown how to be masculine.
We have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. And Doug, I know you need to leave very soon, but we'll continue this conversation for just a few minutes after the break. I'm talking with Douglas Gentile. He is assistant professor of developmental psychology at Iowa State University. He's also done extensive research on video games and how they influence those of us who play them. And also with me is Denise Denton. She is a prevention specialist at Youth and Shelter Services in Ames. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to be joined by Christina Summers, who is the author of The War Against Boys, How Misguided Policies Are Harming Our Young Men, and also a recent article in Time magazine. That's coming up in just a moment. You're welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about boys, how they develop and some of the challenges they face as they grow, some of the risks that they face as they grow as well. In just a moment, we're going to talk about the growing education gap. Boys seem to be being left behind in graduation rates for high school and college and in some other ways as well. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. Right now with me is Denise Denton. She is a prevention specialist at Youth and Shelter Services in Ames. Douglas Gentile is also here, assistant professor of developmental psychology at Iowa State University. And Doug, before we let you go, we've been talking a lot about how media shapes boys' expectations for themselves. And I have this question from Robin in Iowa City. She wonders how playing sports-themed video games affects boys' actual performance in sports and their expectations for what is possible out there on the field?
That's a really interesting question, and there haven't been any studies that have directly looked at that. There are certainly studies that show that when you imagine, for example, if you're a tennis player and you imagine practicing your tennis stroke, it actually does enhance your play later on. So practicing it in your mind is perhaps not as good as practicing it on the court, but it isn't unrelated to it. And so it's certainly possible that sports video games would allow some of that as well. Certainly they'll learn details of rules because they may end up getting into situations in the game that, you know, would take 100 games, you know, to have a certain type of thing happen. And so they may end up getting to learn, you know, what's an infield fly rule or something like that, that is not something that happens as often in an actual game. But because they're practicing lots of different iterations in the video games, they get to learn those things. As far as the expectations of what's possible, well, certainly, you know, talked about this personal fable. I think that people all like to think that, you know, they are the exception to the rule, certainly in, you know, the teenage years, and that they're, you know, going to be fantastic and famous at whatever it is they do. And I think this actually serves a very important evolutionary function that, and I noticed this in some of the, you know, the neighborhood kids that, I had one over to my house to play a video game when she was about 8 or something, and she was playing a game that's scored and it shows you exactly, and she got 0%, 0%. And she turned and said, "I'm really good at this game." And she's looking at the number, and she understands what that number means, but somehow it doesn't connect that doesn't actually mean you're good at the game. And it occurred to me that there's actually a real value, because as children, if we think back to 50,000 years ago, as Denise was talking about, you know, at these ages, starting in the late elementary school and into the early teen years, that's when kids would have stopped just staying in a small group, being watched, you know, by a parent, but would start joining the parent, going out hunting, gathering, or hunt, you know, whatever it is. They'd start learning a trade. If you actually noticed how bad you are, you'd get very frustrated very soon and discouraged and quit. And so it may be that, in fact, this ability to believe that I can do anything and I'm going to be the best, despite all evidence, is actually really valuable for kids because it keeps them persevering until they do gain the skills to be good at something.
Well, Doug, I know that you need to go, but thank you so much for being a part of the show today.
Oh, thank you.
Douglas Gentile is an assistant professor of developmental psychology at Iowa State University. And Denise, very quickly, I'm curious, we've talked a lot about boys' expectations for themselves, but as parents, as caregivers, we do tend to give boys, teenage boys, more freedom than we tend to give teenage girls. We are less protective of boys than we are of girls as a society.
Yes.
What are some of the dangers that creates for boys?
Oh, so many. I don't even know where to start. I think that we are more likely to let, well, I don't want to generalize, but boys and girls are given different responsibilities. They're given different privileges. And if those privileges involve a fast car, if your son is allowed to have the car past 10 o'clock, that just puts them in a more vulnerable position. You know, when we allow greater freedom for boys, the dangers are still out there. That, you know, the dangers don't go away. The opportunity for danger, though, puts them more at risk. So if a boy has a later curfew time, he has more time to find those dangers right out there. He's out there where there are more drunk drivers the later at night there is.
But there is
more high drivers.
There's also a flip side to that coin, isn't there? That as we give boys more independence, they also develop more confidence, perhaps?
They do develop more confidence, but I would take you back to my original premise, which is, and Suzanne spoke to this too, that the brain doesn't come online for, you know, reliable decision-making about consequences until we're about 25. And again, they look like they're grown-ups at 17. And they may go through the whole week taking out the garbage just the way they're supposed to. And we think, yes, this is it. We have a self-actualized individual. But in an emotional situation, the brain goes back to that center part of the brain that has to do with survival. It kicks into that more high-risk behavior. It is more likely, like putting the other kid in the car simulator, they are more likely to be involved in risky behavior. So you may have a teenager that does everything that they need to do, and they seem very responsible for 9 out of 10 times. But in a highly emotionally charged situation, they are more likely to revert back to that 13 or 14 or 15-year-old brain that is more likely to take a high risk. I was at a conference one time where a woman was talking about suicide, and I thought she made a very good point. She said, you know, junior high kids think more about suicide, but high school kids are more likely to get it done because they do usually have more access to the kinds of things that can get it done. They do have a car that they can drive off the road. They are more likely to know where the guns are hidden and have been shown how they are used, whereas you would be less likely to give your 12-year-old an opportunity to load a gun or know where the gun is. But a 15 or a 17-year-old, you might be more likely to have taken them hunting, so they know how that works.
And Denise, we're out of time for this part of the conversation. Thank you so much for talking with
me
today.
You're welcome.
Denise Denton is prevention specialist at Youth and Shelter Services in Ames. She's been doing that for 38 years. And now with me is Christina Hoff Summers. She's the author of the book, The War Against Boys, How Misguided Policies Are Harming Our Young Men. And she recently wrote an article in Time magazine called School Has Become Too Hostile to Boys. Hello, Christina.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And we do see, borne out in numbers, high school graduation rates, college graduation rates, that girls are graduating from high school at a higher rate than boys. Women are graduating from college at a significantly higher rate than boys now. And if we look back a few decades, the numbers were different. But when did this change?
It began to change in the early 90s, and it's almost as though girls just took off and never looked back. And it, and what is happening with girls is going on across the ability distribution, across all racial and class, ethnic lines. The girls are simply performing better than their male counterparts.
Why is that? What has changed in our schools from your perspective that has created this shift?
Oh, I think it's a number of things. One, I think, is that we did acknowledge that gender was significant in education, and there were strong efforts to meet the needs of girls. We have all sorts of elaborate programs, outreach to strengthen girls in math and science to make them more outspoken in the classroom. And I think what happened, sadly, is that boys were put on a back burner, and people just thought, oh, they're fine, we don't have to worry about them. Well, we do have to worry about them. And just as there were areas where girls needed help, there are many, many more areas where boys need help. They need help in special help in literacy. According to the Department of Education, the average 17-year-old boy has the writing skills of a 15-year-old girl. They need help in we need to make our classrooms more welcoming. And we're not doing a good job of that right now.
Right. One of the points that you made in the article that you recently wrote in Time magazine was that we have less tolerance for boy behavior in a classroom. Boys tend to be more physical, more active. Their play, imaginative play, often involves more aggression, even imaginary aggression. But we seem to have very little tolerance for that in our classrooms.
That's right. And I think this is something that's changed dramatically. I think teachers at one time sort of automatically accommodated the male style. They understood boys need lots of recess. Girls need it too, but boys have a critical need for lots of breaks and get out their energy. But once they're even in the playground today, a lot of play is carefully monitored. There are many schools that don't allow tag or elimination games, and the typical play of little boys is called rough and tumble play, and they will do it, almost all of them will do it almost all the time unless you stop them. And it involves a lot of mock fighting and chasing and sound effects. This is very different from aggression. There are the experts on, you know, playground dynamics, like Anthony Pellegrini at the University of Minnesota, has stressed over and over again that when kids are being violent, they're unhappy, they part as enemies. When boys are rough and tumbling, they are not just happy, they're joyful. And they're cultivating friendships, they're learning all sorts of things about their limitations and their strengths. And so I think as we've come down too hard on boys, this is the natural play of little boys everywhere. There's never been a culture where boys didn't evince this behavior. Girls do it too, but a lot less. The typical play of little girls is sort of imaginative theatrical games, turn-taking games, exchanging confidences with a best friend, and boys rarely do those things.
And, of course, many different research studies have shown us that play is incredibly important as children learn and develop and grow.
Yes.
And in your article, you point out that very often the girls will be allowed to pursue their imaginative play where the boys will get interrupted and redirected.
That's right. That was a finding of Mary Ellen Logue and Hattie Harvey, these two wonderful researchers at University of Maine, and what they found was that, as you said, play is critical. It's a critical to the basis of learning, and little boys' heroic play, since the teacher disapproves of it, it's not going to be the basis of learning. It becomes the basis for shame, and we've seen these are the cases that make the headlines, but everyone will be familiar with stories of little boys suspended, you know, 6 or 7-year-old boys for pretending to kill bad guys or conquering. One little boy was thrown out of school because he was suspended because he threw imaginary grenade in order to save the world. Now this is a kind of play that most 5, 6, 7-year-old boys will engage in. And what Mary Ellen Logue and her colleagues found was that not only did teachers interrupt and redirect and try to get them to play more like the girls, but they, with the girls, there's a lot of interaction, a lot of just verbal cues, And the boys don't get that. So the boys lose on two counts. They lose psychologically because of the disapproval, and then they don't get that interchange that's so important to early, you know, verbal development.
Now, in asking this question, I want to make it very clear that I understand that attention deficit disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is a very real problem, and that medication has helped many, many people who suffer from it. But we do medicate ADHD, and we do find that many, many, many more boys than girls are diagnosed with ADHD and put on medication. Do you feel that there is a problem with how often we're treating this? Is this part of this lack of tolerance of more
yes,
active
behavior?
I
agree with you. I have never in any of my writings come out against prescribing Ritalin for children who are genuinely afflicted with ADHD. It's a terrible condition, and the child typically can't make friends and can't be invited anywhere. It's just bounce. I say he because I think 75% of the kids diagnosed are boys. But we know, and I think even the psychiatrists who prescribe Ritalin will tell you that it's overprescribed. And there is a case to be made that in the United States, we are medicalizing just young maleness, youthful, rambunctious maleness. And I advise parents, if you are given this diagnosis, get a second opinion and also consider sending your boy to a boys' school. Where they're used to high-spirited male behavior, and they have ways of channeling it to good ends.
Are you an advocate of separate gender education?
I'm not an advocate for everyone, but I just wrote a piece in The Atlantic. Unfortunately, the ACLU is going after single-sex schools, claiming that it's a form of discrimination comparable to race segregation. And I find that absurd because so many kids flourish in these schools, and I think it's one part of the solution to the boy gap in education and the girl gap in math and science. There's some evidence that girls are strengthened in these fields in an all-girl environment. And boys are certainly helped in taking their lessons more seriously. And they can't let girls run the school newspaper and, you know, direct the play. They have to do all of those things. So I think it makes children more well-rounded and more academically serious. This isn't true for all kids. I mean, co-education is the American norm. That's not going to change. But for a parent of a child, especially a boy, who is not focused and the school can't cope with him, this just recently happened to a friend of mine. Her son was seeing psychiatrists. The solution turned out to be a boys' school. And she told the teachers, oh, he's going to be a problem. They said, we can handle it. And they just seem to have boy-friendly techniques. There's a lot of action, activity, outdoor, you know, sports, and reading assignments that interest high-spirited little boys, and tolerance.
We are very nearly out of time. We have 30 seconds left. Do you think that more research needs to be done into understanding how boys learn?
Yes, I think it should be a subspecialty in schools of education. I think the first thing we should do is admit that on average, boys and girls are different. And it's not that they have different IQs, but it's that they are their styles of learning are different, what interests them, their propensities.
Well, Christina, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Christina Hoff Summers is the author of the book, The War Against Boys, How Misguided Policies Are Harming Our Young Men. She recently published an article in Time magazine called School Has Become Too Hostile for Boys and has done extensive writing on this subject as well. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, it's the girls' turn. We're going to talk about how girls develop, the risks that they face, how they are influenced by media, and how they are educated. Talk of Iowa is produced by Ben Stanton, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had technical support today from Tony Daner and Jason Burns. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio News.